So this is a project that I work with Jirai Aksoy, who's based in the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development. And we have been thinking about this project for about a year and a half. I've presented in the short versions of it, but never had the full-length presentation. So this is the first chance to actually go through the whole story. It's a paper with a, like, I'll do it like that. So first, let me start with a bit of a background. Population aging and decline has been one of the important challenges that we have seen in advanced economies over the last 2-3 decades. And there is a lot of debate about how we can alleviate the problems associated with population aging. And these problems are related to increasing public expenditures on pension schemes and health services, and like shrinkage in the labor market, and especially in competitive areas, and need to and unchanging patterns of public health. So people have been worried quite a lot in advanced economies about this negative consequences of population aging. And then one potential solution to the population aging has always been put forward, that why don't we have more migrants, and whether immigration can alleviate these problems or not. And the people who study population aging from a demographic perspective, they argue that population aging is primarily driven by low fertility, but also it's driven by life expectancy. But the primacy has always been given to the low fertility. And this led a number of scholars and demographers to think about whether we can have replacement migration, enough people with the young and fertile age group to replace the shrinking populations, to keep the age structure of the population constant over time, so to alleviate the problems of aging. So in theory, younger migrants both may rejuvenate the population, but they also might help increasing the fertility rates of the population, because they will be in most likely in fertile ages. So this idea has been debated a lot among demographers, and international organizations constantly produce simulations, UN is one of them, about population projections, which countries are going to shrink dramatically more in the next 20 years or 30 years, and which countries need more migrants to actually replace the populations, have been quite in the policy agendas in various international organizations. And then the scholars who studied these issues, they argue that migration is actually only a partial solution or a part of a mixed bag of solutions. It cannot be the key solution to the issues of population aging and low fertility. It's because two things that have been argued clearly. One of them is fertility of migrants assimilate after some certain period into the fertility of natives. So it's only a short window of time that fertility of migrants are higher than the fertility of natives. So it makes only a temporary solution. So we need actually a constant flux of migrants at the fertile ages if we think that this is a solution. And UN produced multiple projections to simulate these scenarios, and they come up with unreasonable numbers. There is this one paper that shows the size of migration required, the flux of migration required for Korea to stop the population aging and shrinkage, which is one of the most rapidly aging societies, was about 94 million migrants annually, which means that over a 2030 period time of the projection, almost half of the world have to live in Korea. So this is obviously unrealistic, but these projections, regardless, are being produced by international organizations. And then you would see, typically, in most media outlets, headlines like this: why Europe needs more migrants. This is an economics article, a short article with some figures and data. It says, without them, the continent's population will start to shrink. And so that's one of the major concerns. And it says, basically, there are certain countries here on the chart. They look at the countries with and without migration, which one of them will be shrinking. And then they identify only four countries where the population rises with or without the migration. This is Ireland, France, Britain, and Norway, where the fertility rates are sufficiently high. So these kind of debates were our starting point to think about this question, because most of these projections almost always assume that fertility of natives are constant when migrants arrive to a country. So they do simulations or decompositions or projections where fertility of natives are constant, and then it becomes an accounting procedure where how many more migrants we need to the population, keeping the constant of the fertility of the natives. And then we say that assumption might not be realistic, and then that might be missing one of the core issues in the debate. So we do think that migration may affect the behavior of the natives regarding fertility, And then we do think that knowing how it affects and who's affected by it is an important question to answer. And then we started from that point onwards. And then we thought, if migration affects natives' fertility, and then all of those projections produced by UN, Eurostat, and others, by the way, the previous projection, the slide, was produced by Eurostat. It's not only UN. Eurostat also officially produces every other year population projection statistics too. So if the natives' fertility are affected positively, it means that these projections are underestimating the role of migration on alleviating the problems of population aging. So there is a reason why we think that most of these projection models need to take account of behavioral responses, so that's one of the implications that we care about in our paper. And then also we want to know who's affected, who responds among the population subgroups when migrants arrive in a country in terms of increasing their fertility, because it's directly related to the social mobility and future life chances of the children who are born to specific population subgroups. So in theory, the sign is not clear. So there are few theoretical discussions about how behaviors of natives might change when they encounter with higher fertility migrant groups. And then there's need for empirical tests because we haven't seen any direct empirical evidence in the literature about this. So it may be positive or negative, depending on the type of composition of migrants, and depending on the differential between migrants and natives' fertility, and depending on a number of other factors about the how large the migration is, how much contact is there, and so on. So that theoretical discussions have been always pinpointing these particular channels about how the effect goes on. So we thought that there's time to actually produce some empirical evidence whether this is the case in the first place. So there's another reason why we might want to think about it. There is a sub-strand of literature that thinks about the assimilation of migrants into the native society. And then that sub-strand of literature always thinks that fertility of the natives are constant, and the migrants' fertility assimilates into the natives' fertility rather than experiencing a convergence. There is one paper in demography by Phil Morgan, I think, just mentioned somewhere that convergence is a possibility, but people never understand or explain how that convergence happens when it comes to behavior like fertility, which is very much not studied in this context. So what we do here is we want to first understand whether we can say causally migration does affect fertility or not. And then we want to use massive migration from northern Syria to specific Turkish provinces soon after 2011 as an exogenous source of variation to exposure to migration. The reason why we want to do that is if migrants select this destinations are based on certain characteristics that are related to their fertility intentions, and it might be a selection issue that is generated in the destination areas, where it might be pulling certain type of migrants there, and it might be affecting the creating a spurious correlation between natives' fertility and migrants' fertility. Also, migrants often are not the representative sample of their host, origin countries either. A certain characteristics of migrants might be self-selecting to cross borders too. So we want an exogenous source of variation that is independent from the composition of the natives in the destination areas. So therefore, we look at this northern Syrian mass migration to Turkey, and then we use two different empirical strategies. One of them is difference and differences. The other one is instrumental variable methods to get the exogeneity issues out. I'm not going to go in details of IV methods. I'm happy to provide anyone more slides at the end about those if they need the questions. And then we analyze four potential mechanisms, which if you're asking the question, why should migration, migrants affect the fertility of the natives, or what are the channels through which they affect? We propose four of them. The first channel is about the childcare costs related. Another one is about house prices related. The other one is about the labor market shocks related. And then the final is the social interactions. All three are related to the context of the destination areas. And the last one is about the interactions about the individuals, natives and the migrants. I'll come back to those in detail and show evidence whether we could rule out some of them and we could just find supportive evidence about the others. And then we take advantage of various data sets in Turkish setting, which is useful for us because the data sets that we use are vital statistics data sets or labor force survey data sets. They strictly sample Turkish natives. They don't really include migrants background, and then they don't, they separately record the children born to mixed marriages, if that's a question, so in Syrians and migrants. So we can identify these different groups more clearly. And then we want to know, like we described at the end, which population subgroups respond to influx of migration in terms of increasing their fertility. And we find, I'll just tell you the summary of our findings. What we find that basically there's a positive effect of fertility of in the areas where migrants arrive from Syria heavily. And the effect sizes are reasonable for a shock like this. We found around 4% increase in the GFR. And we estimate that translates into approximately 12,000 additional births over the treatment periods for each year. And according to the individual data, so we have the labor force survey, we have measures of like whether you have any children in your household under the age one on a cross-section time series that we can identify added new child in a group, where they report about 1.6 percentage point increase in the likelihood of having a new child in the home. So we found out like the increase could be most likely to be explained by the mechanisms related to the labor market and social interactions, not so much by childcare and house prices. And we found out that the results are primarily driven by low-skilled women in the bottom income quartile and income tercile. And primarily, they are employed or unemployed, but they are not the ones that are who's out of labor force after the migration happens. So we know more or less the profile of women who are more likely to respond in terms of fertility. And this then has an implication about the children born to low-income groups and women who are unskilled and most likely to be like informally employed. So our basic contribution is we relate our research to different strands of literature, which is, we think that this is the first evidence on the effects of mass migration on fertility behavior. Actually, whether migration affects natives' fertility behavior generally is asked by two other papers that we know of in the literature. One of them is the Delia Forzado paper published in Demography. But that's not about mass migration. It's about historical long-term migration in the U.S. in certain cities over a century, and then looks at whether the like fluctuations in migration waves are affecting the childcare costs, which then affects very high-skilled women's fertility behavior because childcare costs becomes like cheaper in those areas where in the U.S. where the migrants arrive. The other paper is in the French setting, Donin, Frank, and Rapoport published, and they argue that the migrants from rural France to Paris area ended up affecting the Parisians' fertility rates within country and their attitudes and fertility intentions in those settings. And then they brought back those attitudes to their rural areas again. So like, that's kind of a slightly different paper. So it's not about mass migration, but it's about within-country migration and diffusion of norms and values in fertility, like when the one area natives meet to rural migrants. So we don't know any other studies other than these two that contribute, like that discusses these questions. And then we thought that we can, like our research is also contributes to a much broader and growing area on the effects of mass migration and refugee migration on some natives' outcomes. This literature is big and growing big, and it's predominantly focusing on labor market outcomes, whether employment, wages, and unemployment, and so on. It started with the David Card's seminal paper in 1991 about Memorial Boat Lift, which is the port in Cuba, and all the Cubans with the boat lift arrived in Florida area, and then they found having no effect on the wages and labor market outcomes of the natives who were living in Florida when the Cubans arrived, and then created a long debate from 1991 until 2017. There published about 15 papers replicating that study. Morehouse, David Card, and Giovanni Perry, these are like the three big names on this area. They subsequently published each of them three or four papers, whether there's an effect or there's no effect. But the argument is behind in these studies was there's this mass influx of migration in a local area, and then does it affect labor market outcomes or wages? Similar settings then expanded to mass migration to Israel. Jennifer Howe and Michael Clements reviewed some of those studies along those lines. And Algerian mass refugee migration to France all looked at the labor market effects of the natives. And then there are some other similar designs to ours, papers on trade, foreign direct investment, moving to the more economics discipline. They look at the Vietnam boat people lifted to like certain areas in the US, influx of these people in the US have affected some trade relationships or other things on those specific areas where the natives learn about those countries. So people have looked at how natives are generally affected by these mass influxes, but fertility has been almost always outside. So then our paper kind of contributes to understanding these how mass influxes affect fertility behavior, and it can be somewhat generalized to the studies where you can think about where the mass influxes are happening across the world. And so that's the nature of the migration that we are dealing with is mass refugee migration, which might be slightly different than economic migration in the long term. So, and then in practice, mass refugee migration influxes are not stopping. So over the century, over the 20th century, there has been quite large waves of mass refugee migration in different parts of the world. And then we hope that this type of designs could help us to think about in these different settings, such as Rwanda. Rwandan migration in Tanzania has been studied a lot for looking at health outcomes, like human capital and education outcomes. So now there's new studies coming from Afghan migration to Pakistan. So these mass influx of migrations are happening, so that's what we hope that we contribute to these debates by looking at a slightly different outcome than what is traditionally being studied. So the outline of my rest of the talk is change a bit compared to my previous presentation of this work, because I decided to give a bit more context on Syrian migration to Turkey, give the first results, whether we find an effect or not, and then move on to why do we find these effects, what are the potential mechanisms, and then we can talk about what the results say about the potential mechanisms, and then we finish with conclusion and discussion. So the context is this. Turkey basically hosts the largest refugee population ever recorded by the UNHCR, and more than half of all Syrian refugees in the world lives in Turkey, and it amounts to almost 4% of Turkish population. So before the civil war in Syria, migrants from Syria to Turkey was negligibly small. So we have also, by the 2010 figures, there were fewer than 10,000 Syrians living in Turkey in the entire country. And at the start of the civil war in 2011, the Turkish government has built some of the refugee camps before opening the borders to the influx of migrants, a couple of months before. And the Syrian war started in March 2011, and the major influx started happening from the May onwards. And the first wave of migrants entered Turkey through certain border gates from Syria, and then they were first registered in the refugee camps. When the camps capacity started filling it, they started diffusing the rest of the country. So by December 2011, according to the UNHCR, in the camps there were refugees that are approximately 8,000 Syrians. But 5 years after, the number of refugees in Turkey reached 3 million. So that's this enormous influx in a short period of time. And that's what we use as a source of variation in exposure in different provinces across the Turkey. So this is graphically showing. So civil war started in March here, and then we use between 2012 to 2013 as our year of treatment, where the experimental design happened, where migrants arrived dramatically. We don't look at these areas because then interprovincial movements and mobility makes our analysis difficult. That's why we want to look at the window of period between 2012 to 2013. I stole a map from CIA website about this because I thought that this is, although not visually clear, it illustrates a few points that I want to make more clear than any map that I would try to do. First of all, I want to say that 90% of Syrians come from the border regions to Turkey. So this is the Turkish border, and we have quite a long border with Syria, 900 kilometers approximately. And then almost 90% of them, according to UNHCR data, come from 7 areas that are all border towns. This is important because we don't think that there is a specific selection from different parts of Syria of with different characteristics of people, but we think that the people who were closest to the border, when the war broke out, they are pushed directly as mass influx to the nearest gates. So we use it as a kind of an alleviation of our concern for our design, that it's not about migrant selection, but it's about mass influx, mass push of people who were just living closer to the borders. And luckily, we got the Gallup data, and we have multiple waves of Gallup data, both before the Syrians arrived, for those regions where the Syrians have been pushed, compared to the regions where Syrians arrived. So that's an enormously rich data set to look at the regions, and when we pool them enough, we have very crude but basic characteristics of Syrians in Turkey after the civil war broke up, and Syrians in Syria before the 2012 broke up. Even if it's crude, it gives us some information about whether there's some selection going on in these compositional factors if Gallup data has representative surveys in these areas. And then we see there's some selection might be going on, so that, like, there's the population, Syrians in Turkey are slightly bit more women and children and less educated than the Syrians before the war. I mean, it might be the case that probably certain people have migrated or pushed somewhere else, or some people died, and then more women and children arrived in the area. So there's still, even though we claim that this is a mass influx and push, there might be some sort of a characteristic differences between before and after the war in the center areas. So I'll talk about our empirical strategy to estimate why, do we actually observe a fertility effect in the natives or not. So the first step is basically, as I said, I will describe here the difference and differences strategy. I will not talk much about the IV strategy, but the good thing about our study is basically whichever strategy we employ, we kind of find around the similar sizes of effects and then in the similar direction of the effects, so we're kind of confident, and then different is a simpler design to explain that, so I just decided to start with that. Turkey is divided into 81 provinces, so that CIA map shows nicely, but I will show with a map that I tried to make with data. So these are the provinces, these are administrative units. So there's a governorate in all of them. They're not autonomous, but they have their own administrative units, they register systems and so on. So, and the largest of these administrative divisions are Istanbul, obviously. 14 million people live in there, Ankara 5 million, and Izmir 4 million. So these are large cities. And the smallest ones are on the far east, northern eastern coast, and then southern eastern coast. So administrative areas that are more empty, so to speak. And we define our treatment, as we said, the year 2012. It's the first massive influx came, because that year Turkey received about 500,000. So from 8,000 to 500,000, we thought that would be the first shock, rather than, and then those people have been registered in refugee camps more straightforwardly, and then diffused to the rest of the places, and then for several years, it went out of control. So, and control provinces, we need the control provinces where the people in those provinces are less affected by the migration. It's harder to think about what would be those control provinces. So we went with the simplest definition. We say, we look at the provinces where the refugee to native population ratio is more than 2%. So they're the ones that are affected, receive high amount of refugees are treated provinces. And then the ones that are received less than 0.5%, almost very, very little, could be our comparison provinces. And the ones in between are somewhat contaminated group, and for the definitive purposes, we took them out as from the analysis, and we said them they're excluded group. We'll come back to them whether that's a sensible idea or not. And this gives, here's a map that I overstated. I couldn't manage to make Russia not look like a sea, but this is Russia actually. So the red colored areas are the areas where received heavily Syrian influx. It's because they all came from northern Syria and then settled down to refugee camps that are built in the closer to the border areas, and then they went to the nearest city centers from those areas, and then they moved later on to other big cities, which are great areas, and then they have enough Syrian migrants to affect somewhat the population, but not enough or not as high as our treatment areas. So we exclude these gray areas, and then we use the rest of the light blue areas as our control areas. We'll look at multiple ways. We will try to match with certain characteristics of these areas from the random selection of these groups. We will try to look at, divide into like larger administrative regions, and look at the gradients within those regions, those areas that receive a bit more. So in a way that if you look at this region, we'll use these areas as treatment and then these areas as control. If you look at this region, we'll look at these areas as treatment and the rest as control. So we will then look at within region variation two as a gradient. So that gives us a bit more confidence about, it's not about the composition of which provinces are in the comparison group, but it's about wherever you look, where the migrants are heavily there, the natives' fertility responses are still positive. So this is a simplified graph. I have a very more complex version of it because some people are concerned about it. A typical graph that is shown in the difference and differences studies where we want to look at the outcome measures for the areas that are affected, for the areas that are not affected, and after the treatment happens. So like this is a simple graph, but it's simply showing that there's something going on in the affected areas' fertility rates, general fertility rates, compared to the areas that are not affected by it. Although it happened, like, it's because of rounding, it looks like as if it's happening even before the migrants arrive. I have a better graph to show that it's actually the data precision issue when we look at the more fine-tuned data that is not there. And this is for the total fertility rate. So the two outcomes at the province level that we measure that shows that there is something going on more dramatically in the treatment areas after the treatment compared to the comparison areas. And now we want to look at what goes on more in detail by using various data sets. As I said, the first one is the address-based administrative birth records. So they are recorded at very detailed geographical units. So there are sub-units within the provinces record them, and we can have access to them. So, and then they're aggregated up to the province level, and then so higher level, but they are like full birth registers of every like child being born, and they are coming from like vital statistics covering 2005 to 2015. Remember that the Syrian refugees started arriving at the end of 2011, so we have enough years before and enough years after on that. We have Turkish labor force survey, which covers in each round approximately 50 to 70,000 people. It's an individual survey. It's not designed to measure fertility, but we have some crude measures of a child being born or a child being present at home. And then, but it allows us to adjust for a lot of individual level characteristics within the between the households that live in the treated areas versus the households that they don't. And I'll show some results on the individual level analysis as well. And then we use other data sets like Gallup survey, Life in Transition survey, and then there's a private survey company in Turkey that the opinion poll, particularly in 2016, about the attitudes towards migrants. We use these additional data sets to test for some of the mechanisms that I will talk about later. The trouble with the Turkish labor force survey is it exists after 2013, but then we lose quite a lot of precision in the presence of children data. The children cannot be linked clearly to the parents, and then we cannot really say whether there's a child in the present in the household, is it just the household composition changes or not? So we just cut off our data sets in 2013, which gives us only a short after-the-fact treatment. So we can only say the immediate effects of the shock, not a longer-term effect of the shock. So in the province level specification, I'm not going to go much in detail. The only thing that is interesting here is basically we use two outcomes on general fertility rate and total fertility rate at the province level. And now we are interested in coefficients here, which is the arrival of refugees in these treatment areas after the period. And then like we will be looking at this, and we control for a number of province level characteristics. And we do have province fixed effects, year fixed effects, and province specific linear time trends to take into account some differential evolution across these groups. And then, as usual, we do robust standard errors to report them. But to look at the descriptive little data, the areas that receive more migration before the treatment happened, before 2011, basically their total fertility rates were much higher compared to the control areas. So Turkish total fertility rate has just been below the replacement for the last 2 years, so it's almost two now. So Turkey started entering the aging trend very slowly at the very beginning. And that is not the case for those areas, even before the Syrians arrived. So those areas were the high fertility areas in Turkey, even in the absence of the Syrians ever arrived. So there are some level differences in the total fertility rates. So when we look at go back to the map, the total fertility rate actually in the coastal line and on these westernized part of the Turkey is closer to Italy. It's 1.10 or something. So it's quite low between Korea and Italy. So that this part is aging dramatically, and this part is almost like 3%, like total fertility rate is 3. So there is this obviously a level differences in the outcome measures, and then there might be other compositional factors which we need to control for. So that made us worry about what would be our true comparison groups to an area that was already starting with different. That's why we went to look at the regional, sub-regional variations and gradients too. So there are also, that area is also less likely to be educated, highly educated. So the university graduates, the percentage of university degree holders are higher in the control areas or comparison areas. And so is the high school, so they have more likely to have the primary school completion rate. So that's that part of the Turkey where it's affected by the most migration looks like more a low-income country compared to the rest of the country. Unemployment rate was slightly higher, the percentage of people being married was slightly lower, it's a slightly younger population and so on, so these are the characteristics that we need to take into account or adjust when we are making our comparisons. So our first results show that once we take into account those compositional factors, and we want to look at the controlling for demographic factors, unemployment rates, taking into account linear time trends, and then looking at eliminating differences between the provinces within the treatment and control group, and everything, which is we come back to our preferred model, where we have all of these things, yes, except the overkill, the quadratic time trends, we find still a very consistent increase in general fertility rate and total fertility rate among the native population in these areas. So one may think about whether, can we make a test whether it's exactly due to the timing of the fertility? So what we do is we interact each of our treatment coefficients with the time period that is post-treatment. And when we look at the trend, that we can identify that the difference only becomes significant after the T plus, so this is T plus 1 and the T minus 1. Thing. I can't see it very clearly on this. Yeah, T minus 1 and then T plus 1. So starting from the, right after the treatment period that we started seeing the effect. So it's not due to the timing of something else, but it's really true due to the timing of the Syrian migrants' arrival.
So that takes into the 9 months. It takes into account the 9 months needed to actually have a baby.
Right, so, and that's the crude that part of the plus one, minus one gap.
Is that in there? Yeah.
And also, we are just seeing the effects of the rates being shown up. So that's T minus one, T plus one would be from the 2013 to 14 onwards, where the Syrian migrants entered from 2011 to 12 for about 500,000. So it's that continuous underlying trend that we kind of measure them in a discrete way. So we want to break down whether there's a special age group that produces these results and not actually across the board in all age groups. So the summary of it is we find both total fertility rate and general fertility rate. For those who are not familiar with what general fertility rate is, it's the number of births born to women in our definition between on the fertile age, between 15 to 49, per 1,000 women of this age. So number of births born to per 1,000 women of this age group in an area. So we wanted to estimate how much actual births it means. So we come up with an estimation of annually in the post-treatment period, approximately 12,000 additional births are occurred due to Syrian mass migration in this area. And then these results are robust to quite a lot of sensitivity checks. So as I said, we decided to randomly choose some of those provinces from the pool of all country, and then assign what if we use different random subset of sample of provinces as a control group. Every time we replicate this random sampling, these different groups to match with the with the treatment group. And then, like, we see quite consistent results. Maybe I can just show that. Or maybe I show the other one. So what is more important and more assuring for us is, let's look at within the administrative regions, much larger, and forget about the very heavily affected areas. Let's look at the big regions on the map, if I want to go to here. So Marmara, Black Sea, East, South, East, Mid-Anatolian regions are these. So Marmara region is this one, around the Marmara Sea. And Aegean region is the one that is here. These are administrative regions. That includes about 10 provinces here. And Interior Anatolian region is here, and then East, and then the Black Sea coast regions are here. So these are administrative regions. And then we said, like, what if we just look at these regions individually? And then look at, and assume that Ankara is the treatment group in this region, and the rest of the adjacent regions are not. And then we look at individually if each of these regions, forgetting about this heavily high fertile area anyway. So we find that effect to be consistent across those regions too, so which gives us a reassurance that it's not actually the composition of which province is actually the control for. And so, sorry. So that, like, I have a small table for this. If I can click on it. If I can't, I know it's slide 54. This is compositional changes, but I think so. Sorry. So this is these are each region, and then the area that is highly affected are treated as a treated regions, and the rest not. We see significant effects almost all, although we have now smaller sample sizes, the power is weaker on that. But then effect sizes almost identical when we look at the other areas, like 0.6, 0.4. That's the variation that we find out when we look at that. Coming back to individual level analysis, I move on to labor force survey. So you need to meet. Okay. So I move on to the individual level analysis, look at the labor force survey, and we don't have good fertility to measure here. What we have is basically whether a child is under, like, 1 year old is reported being in the household in each year when the household surveys. But we have very large sample sizes, 500,000 observations in these labor force surveys, where we can look at and control for a number of individual characteristics, such as labor market status of the household head, mother, father, husband, and other things too. And then we can look at the compositional factors more clearly. We do the same estimations with fixed effects and so on. Going quickly, so this is the descriptive variables. We see similar differences as we see in the aggregate measures between the control and treatment regions. That's also reassuring. And then we find an effect size of 0.2 percentage point more likely to report that there's a child in the household after the treatment happens in these areas. So we find almost a consistent result between the aggregate level analysis and individual level analysis. So we did similar robustness checks and sensitivity analysis using the labor force survey too, and then we find out that our results in the individual level analysis coming from an independent survey compared to the aggregate level analysis with the vital statistics are quite in line in understanding that there is a clear, confident effect that there is a positive positive effect on the fertility and increase in the fertility in the affected areas. So what are the mechanisms then? Why would migration affect them? So the first one, we said maybe it's affecting the house prices in these areas when the migrants arrive in the areas. They increase the house prices, and house prices might act as a wealth shock for some of the household homeowners, which might be then increasing their fertility. So there's a literature a bit mixed about on this. They argue that in the US, house prices, when they go up, homeowners' fertility go up, tenants' fertility go down. So the composition matters. Like, we don't think that this is plausible. One of the mechanisms is when house prices go up, so there's a lot of remortgaging and extra income and equity extraction too, but mortgage system is not very well established in Turkey. It was very recently built in 2010, so just before the migrants arrived. Very few people take up. So we don't think that this is going to be the case. Regardless, we had a house price index. We said, well, what happens if we throw it into our estimation? Can it just absorb the effects that we find out? And which we don't. We find nothing significant on the house price index, and our coefficients aren't even dented when you include them or not. So we think that this is not the mechanism that the literature discusses about and an effect. So the second mechanism is, well, some is a Delia Furtado mechanism published in the demography. What if these people were absorbed in the childcare industry and domestic services, making it cheaper, so like educated women in the labor force market, they are more able to give birth because of the decrease in the child cost. So that's the story. So while we don't think it's plausible, especially in Turkey, and especially in the treated areas where fertility rate has been always high, and people have lived in extended families, and childcare has never been institutionalized, and the female labor force participation is low, so most women don't work. So it's unlikely, but hey, we have in the labor force survey data some questions that we can actually check if this is the case. So what we have in the labor force survey data is a question asking women who is not working, what is the reason that you are not working? And among those reasons, one of them is childcare cost is high. So if this is the case, if this is the mechanism, we should observe a decline in the childcare costs after the Syrians arrive in the area. And then what we have found here, well, not much. So the people who reported that the reason for not looking for a job, expensive childcare, it hasn't changed before and after the Syrians arrived. So they, like, there were few, and they were still few after the immigrants arrived or not. And then, like, so, well, and we want to split this because the literature, and then Furtado argues it only affects the skilled women, very high skilled women, like who's concerned about the cost of childcare. The effect is not there, and we find some weak effect on the unskilled women, which goes against the idea and mechanism, because this unskilled women, when we look at later on in the data sets, they are most likely to be the unskilled women are like most likely to be driving the fertility anyhow, regardless of the child care cost. And then the idea of this mechanism to work is this should go down. This should go negative. If the Syrian women absorb in the labor markets, reduce the child care cost, we should see a negative coefficient, which we don't. We see a slightly positive coefficient. So that also reassures us. That's not the story. So what about Syrian migrants coming in Turkey? What do they do? And they're not allowed to work, but they're absorbed dramatically in the informal wage market. So they don't stay in the refugee camps. They are diffused in the provinces. Refugee camps only cost very, very small portion of them. So about like 250,000 of them in the treatment year were in the refugee camp. About like 300,000 of them were outside. So these people like have been informally absorbed in the labor market. And then the other studies before us, Del Caprio and Wagner paper published on Turkey on Syrian refugees and labor market outcomes, have identified that these people, on the whole, the effect on the labor market was negative. That actually displaced some groups of people in Turkey, natives, from their jobs after the Syrians arrived, and mostly women who are working in the informal sector, the Turkish women who are working in the informal sector, are negatively affected by the Syrian men who are displacing them from the jobs. So we thought that maybe if that is the characteristics, if the displacement effect goes, then it might be, well, these women now like are jobless, maybe deciding to have child birth, and that might be one possibility, although it goes against the ideas of all the displacement papers, because like the economic theory tells us the children are normal goods, when during unemployment you shouldn't see an increase in the childbirth, like displacement is an income shock, and you want higher income to have the fertility decisions to operate. So if Syrian migrants are affecting negatively on the whole the employment of the native Turkish, you should observe a decline in the fertility. But some people argue that that theory is not applicable in every context, and it might be the case, so we want to test for it. So we found out that unskilled women are entirely driving our results, whether they are employed, unemployed, or displaced. So, which is very interesting. So when you look at it, we find that employed women, when they are unskilled, which is high school and less degree, they have increased their fertility. And unemployed women, they have also increased their fertility. But the women who are out of labor force haven't changed their fertility. We didn't find any effects on them. We have quite large sample sizes here. I don't think that skill power is the issue. We have like 500,000 observations around here. And then we found that the ones who are in the informal sector actually increase their fertility, much less so than the formal sector, which kind of is confusing. So the Wagner story, the other papers that look at the Syrians, displayed the women who are most likely to be working in the informal industry, But they also find that like some of the women who were working in the informal industry and some of the men too, the Turkish men and women, they ended up like switching to formal industry. And there might be some positive effect there. But then we see that effect sizes are even larger for the unskilled group when they were working in the formal industry. So it's not entirely the labor market shock, but we cannot rule out that it's not like labor market shock either. So we have some sort of support for partially the story that they, it might be the case that some displacement happening between switching formal to informal and slightly marginal increases in wages when you switch from informal to formal, which might act as an income shock, which might be driving results for the unskilled population. And we don't see any of that in the skilled population. And in fact, on the contrary, skilled employed women decrease their fertility with a negative coefficient size. So it's more like that's something to do with the educational distribution in the area. So I already summarized what the results are. I'm going to be finishing quite quickly soon. The last one that we are testing, and I think it's interesting sociologically, is social interactions. So early studies place emphasis on the diffusion of fertility norms and competitive breeding. And then there are a few studies in sociology journals about how these norms are diffused across the population groups. But the predictive sign is always ambiguous. And the most individual like sociological studies talk about, do you have a friend who's given a birth? And like, are you affected by multiple of your friends are becoming parents and then you change your norms and attitudes? Well, when you look at two ethnic groups, they're not really friends. And then we don't know like whether the friendship networks are pretty much formed. And then there's a small, tiny ethnographic literature, which was interesting for us to discover, argues this competitive breeding notion, which basically when mass influx of migrants come from one area, they say the populations get into a number competition game. And then the ethnographic literature talks about the cases such as takeover of Fiji from the UK with the natives and the English. They talk about Sri Lanka Tamils. They talk about Northern Ireland. They also talk about Israel and Palestine number game, increasing unusual fertility. And they talk about some of the ethnic competition in South African context as well. So there is this ethnographic literature that talk about there is some sort of, when there's a hostile environment, the fertility rates of both groups started going up as due to competition. We said, well, that's an interesting idea, because we don't think that the individual fertility social connections and network literature is helping us, because I don't know any of the people who are in the affected areas, my parents live in one of the semi-affected areas, that they are actually befriending the native, because the language barriers are huge. So the Turkish people speak Turkish, Syrian people speak Arabic. That very, very, very small minorities in each group, they speak each other's language. It's not immediately like affecting the first of the norms and behavior transmission. So we want to test this using Gallup data, Latin Transition Survey, and then the CONDA survey. So the Gallup data has crude measures of fertility. It's just a frequently cross-section surveys with small sample sizes. We can only use the household composition, and we want to count the number of children present in the households from one way to the other, whether they are increasing or not. So what we find out is like the people who have given attitudes that are negative towards migration in the Gallup survey are more likely to increase their fertility, or to say that more likely to live in crowded households post-migration than compared to the groups that are less unfavorable attitudes. So the questions such as immigration should be reduced, immigration should not be reduced, it's enough of Syrians and so on, we checked with various attitude questions. The people who have most negative favorable attitudes are more likely to live in households that are more crowded after the Syrians arrive. So we also went to this CONDA survey, which is a one cross-section survey of 3,000 people, adult sample. It's not representative of full provinces, so we can't look at the affected and unaffected provinces, but we want to look at the whole country. But we want to see whether there's a gradient about how often the people have contact with Syrians. And then the question asks, how often do you contact a Syrian migrant in your daily life? And the people say, never, which is our reference category, rarely and frequently. We want to see a gradient across these categories, whether the people who have negative attitudes versus positive attitudes among those who contact are more likely to respond to fertility. And that's what we found. We found that like the people who have more negative attitudes and report to have high frequent contact with them are more likely to have higher fertility. So this gives us some support from the ethnographic, demographic ideas where there might be some competition and hostility about the number game. But it's not like full part of the story either. So we see some effects about the non-contact as well, or rarely contact too. So I do think we do think a combination of labor market factors and then some sort of social interactions are affecting these environments of competition for resources, and then affecting the some sort of fertility and number of children number gain. So that's what we do think might be going on. Final two slides. Population subgroups. Who are these people in Turkey, in addition to the main characteristics of being that they don't like migrants, given birth? And we find out they are most likely to be in the prime age when we look at the specific subgroups, looking at the individual data and also the aggregate data. In aggregate data, we didn't find much variation, but individual data provides us the fact that the 25 to 34-year-old women are driving most of the fertility outcomes. And then they are more likely to live in urban areas. They're more likely to be in the lower income group. They're more likely to be there before the Syrians arrived. So we want to test some sort of out-migration from the area too. And then we want to know whether it's about people becoming first-time fathers, mothers, or is it become increasing their family size by having the second and third child. What we find out is like very weak effects on the higher parity, but there are some there, and it's most likely to be the people who are having their first child among the groups that are treated. So it's the most likely the parental transition is accelerated rather than the higher number of parity. So I'm finishing here. We basically find that mass migration increased the fertility in Turkey in the treated areas, and it's quite consistent across various data sets. Now, we do think that labor market mechanisms, a combination with social interactions, are the reasons why we see this increases. And we don't think that child care cost and house price index, as is discussed in the literature, is the relevant case in this final case. And then we found out that additional births are concentrated among unskilled women, low-income groups, urban areas, which are important to understand for the future of these children born in those areas to these mothers, if there are, like, there's direct implications about the social mobility in the country as a whole. And we also think that our results contribute to the importance of understanding these behavioral responses when migration happens, that most international organizations, Eurostat, UNDP, WHO, produce these projections, assuming that there is no behavioral response by the natives when the migrants arrive. So we do think that we contribute to that debate by showing first evidence of it. So thank you so much. Any questions?
I have a question. It's not maybe completely well formulated yet, but thank you very much for your completely fascinating presentation and all the work that you've been doing on this. You mentioned very briefly at the end out-migration, and I was just all the way thinking, particularly, I think it came into my head at the beginning of your presentation because Eastern European countries, you know, Lithuania, Latvia, Romania, you know, are suffering so much out-migration, and I wondered if you could say a bit more about that.
That's excellent. So this is a question that comes often when we look at population subgroups. So we don't have great data to see who actually leaves the area after the Syrians arrive. If that is the case, that is, we are kind of ending up in another spurious correlation issue. Well, the solution to this, a partial solution to this, when we look at the gradients in the other areas, so they might be going somewhere else, and when we look at the within region, we should be able to capture them. So that's one quick answer. But then we have one question in the labor force survey. They say, have you been living in this area before 2012 or not? So like for every wave for the labor force survey, like how long have you been here and have you moved this area right before the survey and so on. So we said, can we just fix our population of those people who have been there before the Syrians arrived and then they remain there? Not great, because we are interested in those who leave rather than those who remain. But the way that we can capture them in the other analysis. What I haven't shown is that we have gone to a different African strategy where we look at matched by Google Maps distances of each provinces to the border gates through which these people entered, and you like collapsed this by pairs and then reported results by using that as an instrumental variable so that we don't arbitrarily allocate people into control and treatment provinces, but we use this continuous treatment of across the provinces and using their distances. Once you control for factors that are like general economic trade and so on, those distances should not be related to people's choices of going in that area. And we find that our results are almost identical. I have a number of slides about that. I have to show time remaining. So we thought that we can just address this out-migration issue by looking at either within a region or looking at an IV strategy that goes around the main problem. But I do think that's a good question, and it comes across, and people say that like when Syrian migrants arrive, some people will go to the areas, some people will leave the areas. I can only see the net migration rates. They are very small. They are like 5,000, 3,000 people, the net migration numbers in these specific treatment areas that we use. But that's because it's net number. Might be larger numbers are coming, larger numbers are going. I can see that like around 12,000 people are arriving and a 15,000 number are leaving. So that composition might matter. What we have done is like we have used these compositional factors as outcome measures, and we want to test whether compositions have changed. So I do have a slide about that too. And we found out nothing on that. At the end we do have some. We didn't find any compositional effects when we used these composition groups using labor force survey. Have their share changed after the migration? We don't find these dramatic changes in any of these compositional characteristics. So we thought that that's one way to indirectly answer the question. Okay. Sorry.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I was thinking, and there are some assumptions in this question, when you were explaining about how unskilled women and women in informal and work environment respond, were you able to look at the specific sectors? Because what I assume is like different regions would have like different sectors more prominent and more important for economic situation of those regions. So how women in different like work sectors respond according to like different regions. So are there always unskilled women responding the most with high fertility or?
Yeah, so we didn't look at within sectors, mm-hmm. but Dal Capri and Wagner and the World Bank, they did in their paper.
Okay.
So we thought that it would be redundant to replicate their study because we use the same set data source.
Mm-hmm.
And we rely on their results, and then they find out like the informally employed women are most likely to be displaced compared to formally employed women by arrival of Syrians, obviously, because mm-hmm. Syrians cannot really work in the formal sector. And they have looked at the five crude sectors, agriculture, textile industry, and a few other things. We didn't look at these specific sectors, and it didn't matter for us because our results were driven by unskilled women directly, whether they are employed or unemployed.
Okay.
Right, so like the only difference that we found out is like we didn't find an out of labor force women changing their fertility pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we restrict the sample at the fertile age women. Right. So that's not the composition.
Yeah, in terms of natives, how have you defined that? Do you include second-generation migrants, minority groups?
That's great. So the question is only asked to the Turkish citizens.
Okay.
And they have to be born in Turkey. So there might be a small subset of groups in the area that are Syrian ancestors. The thing is, like, Turkish-Syrian relationship, like, got cold in 1930s when one of the provinces voted a referendum and annexed to Turkey rather than annexing to Syria.
Yeah.
So in 1937, this province over here, the red one, was an autonomous province after the French colonies left, and they made an election within the referendum, and then they decided to join to Turkey rather than to Syria, and then the relationship got cold for 30 years, and there was border fence. No relationship was there. But before... And that border fence was dramatic because a lot of families were split in between in the smaller villages close to the border areas. Mm-hmm. But there were no contact over 50 years between Syria and Turkey because of that cold relationship afterwards. And there was quite a very tiny minority in this area that were speaking Arabic. Very, very tiny minority. So that's one possibility maybe, but good question. So thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for the presentation. Thanks for giving us so much insight in sort of, you know, all your considerations and all the different things you tried. I think that's particularly insightful for us doing research as well. I have two questions. One is about different differences that may exist between waves of migration. From what I remember, sort of some of the refugee crisis, that first waves of migrants tend to include lots of young men, second wave more families, women and children. So I was wondering if there's a way to exploit some of that variation between waves and see if there's a different effect, particularly in light of that fourth mechanism, right?
Yeah.
Sort of the group threat mechanism. I was sort of surprised that you only brought it up at the end. I mean, that was like the first thing that I thought about, you know, like migration become sort of bringing to bear these tensions that may exist between religious and ethnic groups. And there may not be that much of a sort of current literature on it, but I'm sure there's a historical literature on some of those processes.
Like it's remarkably thin, though, I would say. So, like, these five case studies and ethnographic works, that's all we could find.
Huh. Now, I'm just thinking of Bloomer, you know, like a sense of group position, ethnic competition. I mean, that's super mainstream in sociology.
That's
maybe
right.
the breeding aspect of it hasn't
or
been
fertility
much.
Aspect of it.
Yeah.
Like, people have not really thought about these things. It's about resource competition that's abundant.
Yeah.
But then having a child or like thinking about forming a family is a very remote outcome than most of the sociology discussions have been doing. So one needs to make that additional leap that, okay, then if you're competing for resources, why you want to have a child? So it doesn't go in the same logic as we would expect. So related to your first question is, it's a continuous flux. There are no, like, we don't see the waves. By 2015, the number reached 2.5 million. By December 2011, right before our treatment month, was 8,000. So we have discrete observations from UNHCR, together with the Turkish Migration Office, who were registering rapidly who arrived. And we do have these year averages in our data. We know that there are slightly bit more women and children. Almost 45% of the population is under age 18. So it's a high number of children families, high fertility population arriving a slightly lower fertility area. So the Syrian total fertility rate is about 3.4, and Turkish fertility rate in the areas before the treatment was 3.1. So we do see that still the arriving people have higher number of children than the local natives. So I guess we better finish, right? So at some point, I'm happy to hang around and ask questions. So anyone wants to leave, feel free. So does this answer your question, by the way? We don't have the ways.
It sounds like it's tricky to do, right? I mean, the only thing you could do with the data and the approach you have is sort of try to identify changed infertility rates that happens in the first couple of years, and sort of see if that's different from what happens in the subsequent years.
So we only use this year as a treatment.
Yeah.
Because these years are problematic in the sense that these people may not go directly to the areas where the refugee camps are built. They may be going to the other areas and contaminating our results.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they're in, there's a lot of reshuffling. So we can't use them as treatment years, as exogenous for the natives who are living there in terms of composition.
Sure, but the dependent variable, you're looking at a longer stretch of time, right?
Yeah.